news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clemens, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their community dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Civic Media News, I'm Derek Tritz. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. An appeals court rules the boy accused of killing 10-year-old Lily Peters in Chippewa Falls more than 2 years ago will be tried as an adult. James Kelly reports.
The decision was originally made by a Chippewa County judge, and a three-judge panel in the Court of Appeals ruled to uphold that decision due to the seriousness of the offense. Their ruling states that the defense failed to show that a reversal waiver would not depreciate the seriousness of the offenses. The now 16-year-old suspect is charged with first-degree intentional homicide and sexual assault. I'm James Kelly.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court is considering a request to open guardianship records for some voters. A conservative activist is trying to find ineligible voters and cast doubt on the 2020 election. Justices heard arguments in the case on Tuesday. The court's not expected to issue a ruling before the November election. And that's what you need to know. I'm Derek Tritz, and this is Civic Media News.
How serious is youth vaping? Irreversible lung damage serious? 1 in 10 kids vape serious? Which warrants a serious conversation from a serious parental figure, like yourself. Not the seriously know-it-all sports dad, or the seriously smart podcaster. It requires a serious conversation that is best had by you. No, seriously, the best person to talk to your child about vaping is you. To start the conversation, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Download the free Civic Media app today at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Saw this thing on social media, and I got to tell you, absolutely heartbreaking if this is happening more frequently. Saw the post of a woman who took a picture of her daughter's arm, and on her daughter's arm wrote, "Love you, Mom and Dad." And in the post, she said, you know, so my kids' school had a genuine lockdown today. I say to her, why did you write that on your arm? She says, in case the bad guy got us and I got killed, you and Daddy would know that I love you. And I gotta tell you, you know, I'm not an overly emotional person, but that kind of hit. Because I think about my kids who've had to go through these kind of drills and some of the conversations that we've had over the years about, you know, these situations. Because unfortunately, in today's America, this is a conversation that has to happen. The idea that someone could come busting through the school door, could be walking in through a back door, and do harm on a mass scale, because we're incapable of dealing with this situation. And as I've talked to a couple of people, educators, who have said, look, this is, unfortunately for the kids, this is lunch table conversation. This is stuff that they talk about. It's in their world. It's in their head. And I go, I started thinking back to my own childhood. Look, we used to do those bomb drills. You know, everyone my age knows you'd get under the desk because there was a nuclear bomb scare. Like somehow school desks were the great shelter, the great protector for nuclear winter. But there we went under the desks and, you heard the sirens and go off and, practice, same thing with tornado drills or whatever. Fire drills. We had all these drills on where we had to go, how we had to react, all this stuff. And it's good. The school was preparing us for the realities that potentially could happen in our day. I only remember one actual fire that happened where it was a very, very small one that didn't do much damage, but everybody had to race out to the parking lot and see the fire engines pull up. It was quite a day. But other than that, all the drills that we had throughout my years, there were no bombs dropped. The tornadoes didn't really hit. So it was all just practice. And we never feared that was going to be our reality. We used to joke about the bombs falling because we knew it would never happen. We understood the idea of mutual assured destruction and that, if they're blowing up our schools, we're going to blow up theirs. And no sane, rational person would do that kind of stuff. And so we held, it was kind of a joke. But I see this, and I don't ever remember any of my classmates going, gee, I better tell my parents that, or I better somehow write on myself so they'll know that this was my body part. This is a fact of life now. And this is what bothers me the most is that we've kind of surrendered to it. This kind of acceptance, especially on the right, that, well, there's nothing we can do. This latest shooting, J.D. Vance basically came out and said, well, this is the reality. Deal with it. And immediately, everyone on the right went after everyone on the left. How dare you say that? That's not exactly what he said, word for word, verbatim. It's what he meant. And then they got to change the topic because it was now about the message and not the actual shooting. And now we've kind of forgotten about it. It's done. And now there's a shoot. There was a shooting in Kentucky. They're looking for the guy now because he was able to go buy a gun and 1,000 rounds of ammunition. And no one said, hey, what do you need 1,000 rounds for? And I know my gun nut friends are going to shoot that off in a weekend. Look, I've gone shooting. I get to 100 and I'm bored. So if you're out there with 1,000, I got questions. But it's this acceptance for me. It's this helplessness that I think parents like me feel because we have a political system that's broken. We have a political party that refuses to do anything on the gun issue. And it's angering. Now, there are things we can do. The idea, and this is what I get from people. Well, you're not going to stop all of them. No, you're not going to stop all of them. But maybe you stop a couple of them. And maybe that's your kid. School shootings are going to happen. But we can do real things to tap down the number, to tap down the severity. And I'm one of these people who's all of the above sounds like a good idea. There are people like, well, we need to arm the teachers. I don't know about arming the teachers, but maybe having, someone nearby, maybe not at the door, like an armed camp, but somebody on campus. Not a bad idea that can respond within, a minute or two as opposed to 10. Sounds reasonable and rational to me. Maybe we harden the doors even more. Maybe don't use glass doors anymore. Maybe figure out how to bulletproof glass. There are things we could, should, and must be doing, but we're not. Because my fear is that this is, it's about the issue more than it's about the solution. Because the gun fantasy people have this in their head that a good guy with a gun is going to stop a bad guy. Sometimes. Not every time. sometimes that actually makes things worse. And as I was thinking about it today, and I was looking at this picture and just, man, as a parent, imagining, you know, my kid feeling that kind of despair of, well, you know, this could be my last day. This could be it. And, you know, at 7, 8, 9 years old, the kid in the picture looks no more than 8 or 9 years old, maybe 10 at the most. To have a kid at that age when they should be thinking about recess and what they're going to have for lunch and what, you know, what their friends are wearing or, you know, whatever kids that age think about now. That's what their minds should be. Not on writing messages to their parents in the event that they're murdered at school. It just seems to me that we should be doing something. And what's interesting and curious to me is the NRA has been eerily silent. We've heard nothing from the NRA. Now you could go, Rick, you know, they don't have any more Russian money. They've run out of Russian money, so they're broke. Or you could go the other side, which is mission accomplished. They've won. We won't do anything on guns. We won't do anything to solve a problem that can be, if not completely solved, at least partially solved. The question is do we have the political want, will, and the ability to do it? I don't know. How many dead kids is it going to take? And look, the NRA is not going to come out and celebrate and be victorious going, hey, we won on all of our issues. You know, thank us for all these dead kids. They're not going to. So it is kind of interesting how silent they've been, because in past shootings, you know, at least they threw out thoughts and prayers. There was at least something. But in this day, not so much. And I'll tell you, that's what strikes me. The fact that we've got kids who are going to the bathroom in litter boxes, and not because they think they're cats, but because they're stuck locked in a room, afraid that someone outside is walking around with a gun. You know, those are the kind of litter boxes we should be doing away with, without question. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Greg Sargent's gonna be here to share some thoughts on Trump.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday on the program, we talked about how during the Wisconsin rally, Trump compared himself to Al Capone, his indictments versus the indictments of Al Capone. Talked about when they destroyed the Department of Education, how Ron Johnson, the U.S. Senator, was going to be the one in charge of education there. And praised his final State of the Union address from 2020. How did it go? Not since Franklin Delano Roosevelt has a speech been so brilliantly made or delivered so well. And look, that was just the tip of the iceberg of the crazy train of just that one rally. The thing that gets me is rally after rally, year after year. I keep asking myself, why do people show up for this nonsense? And why aren't we in the media spending even more time pointing out just how crazy it is? Look, Howard Dean is sitting home because he lost his voice and made some weird yah sound. his career over. This guy comes out with just sharks and electric batteries. It's crazy. Here to share some thoughts on, well, maybe there's a moment where we're going to pay attention. This is why I've asked Greg Sargent to come talk with us. He's a staff writer over at the New Republic. He's got a piece out called "Finally, Top Journo Erupts at Media for Ignoring Trump's Mental State." Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on.
So your article put some hope in this Mike Barnicle's throwing down the gauntlet, if you will, that at some point the floodgates are going to open and the media is going to pay attention to the crazy nonsense that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth. Is that the gist of what I'm getting here?
Well, I want to be clear. I think the media does cover his crazy utterances. The key distinction is between doing a series of isolated stories here and there, covering them as isolated news stories that kind of pass into the night, and doing something more broad and systematic, which is covering Trump's obvious mental unfitness for the presidency as a big ongoing story. That, to me, is the thing that's missing. We saw it with Biden's age. The media knew how to cover it as if it were something of immense national importance, and fine, I think that's okay. But another matter of immense national importance is Trump's mental incapacity to do this job. And that is not covered that way.
Well, let me ask you the dumb question then. How is he different now than he was in 2015, 2016? I look at him as, and maybe you'll agree or disagree, I look at him as a comedian whose time has passed. His material is old, it's stale. He hasn't gotten new material, and the crowds aren't responding like they used to. So he's now grasping for whatever, you know, like a drowning man being thrown at anchor, he's going to grab for it. I just see him as somebody whose time's passed him by, but still out there trying to get crazier and crazier to get that high and that attention.
Well, I do think he really is similar to Dustin Hoffman's portrayal of Lenny Bruce in his late years, you know, going on and on about his legal situation to an increasingly empty room. But Trump's room, unfortunately, is still pretty damn full. I do think he has gotten worse on a number of fronts, and I think it's observable. He's less coherent than he used to be. He has more weird lapses and more strange flights of fantasy. And really importantly, he is running on an explicit and open platform of authoritarian threats in a way that I don't think he was quite doing in the same way before.
Yeah, I mean, now it's, you know, but he's aggrieved. I mean, the fact that he has been indicted for the things that he's done, you know, there's this sense of retribution and payback and I'll get you. And on a certain level, I understand if you really feel you were aggrieved, but you kind of did it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you raise a key point there, which is that the larger context here is that Trump is facing criminal trials for his many alleged crimes. And he's facing sentencing for crimes that he was convicted of. And so there really is sort of an opening for him to run on a more authoritarian platform than before, essentially vowing to pardon all the January 6th insurrectionists for attacking the Capitol, treating what they did to the country as a positive and good and patriotic thing. He doesn't say this openly, but we all know that he would immediately cancel all ongoing prosecutions of himself if he becomes president. We know this because he keeps saying they're illegitimate. So in a sense, the kind of larger context here has created the opening for a much more clearly authoritarian campaign.
No, the thing is, he's open and honest about it. You know, he's literally saying the quiet parts out loud, and his base, they seem to be really okay with it.
I think they like it. I mean, the way he's campaigning to his base is that January 6th was good. I think it's very hard for some, I think, in the press to wrap their heads around that idea. But that really is what he's saying. When he says the January 6th rioters are patriots and heroes, he's saying that political violence undertaken on behalf is a good thing. And that's what he's campaigning on.
Now, I've argued for a while that our media has not really gone after him the way they should and reported on the crazy stuff that he said. Because, look, I can do a show every day on what crazy nonsense he spews at these speeches. But I argue that he has done a masterful job of attacking the media and making them on the defense. And they've kind of gotten rabbit ears to where, oh, we can't say much or he's going to attack us again. Any Do you think that's somewhat near correct, somewhere in the ballpark?
I don't know whether it's the attack. I mean, I think the attacks probably factor in. I'm sure a lot of newsroom leaders and so forth and executives worry about being perceived as being hostile to Trump in some sense, overly hostile, I should say. But I really think that the real issue is that the conventions of political reporting today have been really strained to the breaking point by what Trump does kind of daily in an in and out way. And those conventions are just dying for a real set of reforms. And that to me is the issue, right? The way they do headlines, the way they decide what's newsworthy, the way they decide what's placed where, the way they decide what gets saturation coverage and what doesn't, that's the type of thing that clearly has been revealed as very faulty, I think, by Trump's way of doing politics.
No, and look, you know, I've said for years, the sad reality is we don't do media like I remember. Now everything's about clickbaiting. Everything, you know, newspapers don't have advertisers to keep them afloat so that they can pay investigative journalists to actually do real reporting. Now it's now in the second, hot takes immediately to get those eyeballs as quickly as possible because that's where the money's at. So aren't we really talking about how we fund our media?
I don't really know whether that's an issue. I've never really felt it's a systemic problem in that kind of way. I really do think it's more about the way journalists do things, that the sort of conventions that we've come to accept as the way news is written and presented, those things are really what can't really seem to cope with someone who just lies with abandon at all times about everything without exception, who, you know, engages in the most virulent and despicable hate speech that you can imagine from a figure of that stature. That type of stuff, I think the press doesn't really know how to handle. I think it's improved greatly. And I think, by the way, I should say, I think we're all struggling to figure it out, right? I just, you know, to me, it looks like the institution of the political press has not solved the Trump problem.
Yeah, no, I agree with you because, you know, every day he says 15 things that in my lifetime, would just one of them would have taken out a presidential candidate. And I guess that's the amazing thing. I mean, just the sheer number of really outrageous you know, fantasies that come out of his mouth every day that people that I know that I respect that take as fact is kind of frightening.
Well, there's really no end to the amount of lying, and the thing is, after he's been fact checked and debunked, you know, to the hilt, he just keeps repeating them.
Yeah,
so I think there's a tendency by the press to sort of say, well, we already fact checked that, and this is one way that he's kind of hacked the code, right? He's picked the lock on how to get around these types of, you know, filters.
But let me ask you this then, because isn't that because I've argued for years, and even before Trump, that this was the world that the right lived in. You have these think tanks that create these messaging platforms. They create these narratives. You've got, you know, right wing talk radio that dominates the airwaves and cable news that then takes those bits and pieces and puts it out there for people to buy. And then politicians then cite this stuff. It's its own incestuous pool of insanity. And now we have a term for it: alternative facts. I think it's more than just Trump. I think it's an entire ecosystem.
Yeah. Look, it's been they've run a campaign for over 50 years, more than half a century, attacking the press as supposedly liberal and biased against them. And it's worked really beautifully. Trump has kind of taken some of this stuff to another level by virtue of the way he lies and the types of things he says, which, look, I don't want to overstate this, but there are certain things that he does and says now that a lot of more establishment Republican types really are reluctant to do themselves. You kind of see this. There's an interesting split opening up among Republicans when it comes to pardoning the January Sixers. You've got some of the old establishment types who really are willing to say, well, look, no, if they committed crimes, they need to pay, right? And then meanwhile, you've got other Republicans, maybe more than half, unfortunately, of congressional Republicans. That's just an estimate, but something like that. Essentially saying, okay, well, if Trump says that what they did was good on January 6th, then I'll offer a soft version of that. It's, you know, it's understandable. It was a tourist visit or something like that.
Yeah, they were between the velvet ropes. I've heard all of the arguments, and it shows what kind of cowards they are. that they're not going to stand up, because ultimately, and this is the one of the weird worlds that I'm in, is, you know, I you know, when Joe Walsh was a congressman in, from Illinois and in Congress, he was my personal chew toy. He was somebody who every day I talked about how crazy he was. And now we're friends fighting on the side of saving democracy. So, you know, Trump has united some groups, but...
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And there's a real anti-MAGA coalition out there. I mean, whether it's enough to win the election, I think we'll find out. I think it might be, but, you know, it's kind of frayed around the edges. But it's kind of been heartening to see the kind of never Trump Republican types, both kind of the, you know, the ones of very, very great prominence, like Joe Walsh or Bill Kristol, those types, but also the voters, right? I mean, I think in the 2022 elections, especially, there was a small slice of Republican voters who voted for Democrats. And, you know, that is a pretty heartening development. I really hope it holds this election.
Yeah, I mean, because ultimately, and you're right, you know, we haven't seen the kind of reporting that I would like to see on what a Trump presidency would look like outside of the discussions around Project 2025, which on one hand he says he doesn't know anything about, doesn't read, isn't a part of, but on the other side says, you know, there are lots of great things that people want. It seems like he's around every side of the issue all the time, depending on where he's at, and nobody's gonna. And this is why where my concern for the debate is going to be, where you're going to have, you know, Trump just spewing nonsense and none of the moderators bothering to say, no, that's crazy.
Well, a lot's going to be on Kamala Harris to really debunk these things in real time. And I just tweeted on this, but my view is that she's got to be really crisp about it, like quick, brutal takedowns of each falsehood and then move on. Don't get bogged down, but don't let that stuff go unchallenged, because this is the moment to tell the American people that what Trump is saying about the economy, about crime, about immigration, it's all bull. She's got to get that across. It's not the only thing she's got to do, but she does have to do that.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, as someone who has spent, you know, his career in media, you know, walk us through how you think we come back from this. Is Trump a one and done? Is there someone that we are concerned that comes up behind him? Because I've always said, if there is another Trump type, he will be the most dangerous one, because we've learned the lessons of all the things that Trump did and got away with and didn't. So I guess the question is how do you see us coming back from this, or is there a way of coming back?
So it's kind of I'd offer a mixed answer, and I want to preface it by saying that, you know, this is all very murky stuff, and who knows how this is all going to play out. But if Trump is beaten, I got to think it's a pretty serious blow to the MAGA movement, because this guy is really the most talented demagogue I think we have seen in decades in American politics. I've never understood why people say he's easy to beat. He's not. This guy is a very good politician for the demographics he's trying to appeal to and more. So, you know, if you look at someone like Ron DeSantis and to some degree J.D. Vance as well, they've not been able to replicate the Trump's version of the MAGA magic, right? So I think you do need that perfect demagogue to do what he's done. On the other hand, there's a genuine movement behind him, as DeSantis and I think Vance to a greater extent here really show. And that movement, I don't know if it's going anywhere. I mean, those kind of pathological obsessions of theirs are widely and deeply felt, maybe not by much more than a quarter of the country, but it's a real durable thing, I fear.
No, and that's an excellent point, because I don't believe Trump has any real true values. I think he's the worst right. kind of used car salesman. It's all about getting him attention, getting what he wants, as opposed to where I think, as you point out, J.D. Vance, DeSantis, that slice of the Republican Party, they're hardcore ideologues with an absolute, you know, Sharia, Christian Sharia law type agenda, which is really frightening. Look, I look at Trump 2015, 2016. Didn't agree with him, you know, fearful that knew he was going to win, but scared to death of what it would be, knew it was going to be horrible. But I found him entertaining. I mean, you know, he's one of those guys where, you know,
that's the thing.
As crazy as he was entertaining.
He is entertaining in his own deeply twisted and perverse and grotesque way. It's just true. I mean, and And I think an interesting thing, a Democrat I know was telling me that one of his daughters went to a Trump rally, or maybe her friends did. And after that Trump rally, phones were lighting up, right? Everybody's phone was lighting up with pictures, with memes and all kinds of things. He kind of lights the place up in this way that I don't know if we've ever really gotten into our heads, right? He has a way of performing and activating kind of a cultural movement that is really kind of special, unfortunately.
No, you're so spot on. But Greg, I appreciate the time. Hope folks will take a look at the work that you do over there at the New Republic. We'll get some links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Greg Sargent, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, man.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Do you think it's possible to come back? Do you think it's possible that the Republicans can find a replacement if he's gone here, hopefully in November? And I'm hoping. rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
News, talk, community, and local sports. Thanks for listening to Civic Media.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
This Civic Media station is currently broadcasting the Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks over the air. Due to streaming restrictions, we can't provide you the broadcast here. You can find an affiliated station at civicmedia.us to find the game over the air. We'll also have updates on the game and the biggest sports news from Mike Clemens daily on Civic Media stations all across Wisconsin.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Today's U.S. Bowling League Day. I am not in a bowling league. I think that would actually be kind of fun.
Oh, yeah.
I do like to bowl. But
you got the bowling shirt going on tonight there, Pete.
I do have the bowling shirt. In case the game breaks out, I'm ready. Because I was raised, I'm a street bowler, Chris. I'm ready in case a game breaks out. It could happen.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Football season upon us, and yeah, high hopes. I had high hopes for my Broncos. New quarterback, young guy. I was hoping... They got pretty badly thrashed on Sunday. But, hey, the one thing that I found out, and I'm surprised I didn't know this, all those pigskins, all those footballs that are thrown around, union-made in the U.S., in my home state of Ohio. A factory in Ada, Ohio, 140 people about working this unionized environment to create, well, the balls that we love seeing being thrown, kicked, and carried around. And this, again, why I love the fact that we make stuff in this country and why we should be doing more of it. And on that note, that's why I want to talk to my good friend Scott Paul. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you as always.
So I love when we have American-made products, especially in a sport that I love. Good stuff.
Yeah. We really enjoyed this. And so whenever a sports season starts or something like the Olympics, we like to try to scout out, like, you know, how American made is it, right? And so it is very cool. And so, look, I would just say if you go into a sporting goods store and you're buying a football for your kid, the odds are it's not made in the United States. I just want to say that True. Kind of flat out right now, unfortunately. But it is great because the NFL Wilson – Sporting Goods, which is a very popular name, you know, they do have a great partnership. And, you know, in fact, these premium footballs are getting so popular that they've had to add factory space and they've added workers, which is really awesome. And they are made by Workers Unite, union workers in Ohio, which many people consider to be the cradle of football. Although I don't like any teams from Ohio college-wise or professionally, but that's all good. It's where the Football Hall of Fame is. That is well worth visiting. It's like in the DNA there. And so it's really cool to see those workers get a shout out. And Jeff Bonner on our staff did an amazing story of kind of catching up with them and chronicling all of this. But it is one of those things that when you see that in the hands of Bo Nix, or in the case getting knocked out of the hands of Bo Nix, that it's made by American workers with American leather that comes from Chicago, by the way, that those quarterbacks are throwing around.
No, and it's, again, it's another one of these things where, you know, as you point out, you're making them in Ohio. The leather's coming from the Chicago area. It's that supply chain to create this one thing. Maybe if we did that thing with things that are a little more important. Look, football's important, but things that are a little bit more important, you know, like drugs and steel, and you know, go down the list of things that we should be making, the jobs that could be created out of it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it is that perfect example of when you have a more domestic supply chain, the value that comes out of that. And sometimes the security, as we've pointed out many times, Rick, comes out of it as well. And it's also nice to see workers lifted up, because obviously, you know, the NFL players are unionized, and they have issues that they bargain around. You know, salaries is not something that some of the NFL players have to worry about very much, but it's nice to see the workers who are behind the scenes giving them the products they need every day. They have good jobs that are well-paying jobs because of Workers Unite. And I'm glad that we're able to lift those stories up.
Do we know if this is something contractual in the NFL, that the balls have to be sourced domestically, like uniforms and all of that, that I've heard in the past, that it's actually something that the Players Association negotiated into their contract? Is that in there?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I don't know specifically, but I do know that in this case, And I guess I just wish it would extend to more of the merchandise that's, you know, that's branded and sold, but that there is a great partnership that they have to do this. And obviously that extends to a lot of the safety equipment as well that the players utilize. And, you know, these footballs are also accessible, you know, which is great. I mean, you'll pay a little bit of a premium for them, but you get a great product. You know, you're not going to get one of those playground balls that falls apart as soon as it hits the dirt or whatever, and the seams split apart. You know what I'm talking about.
No, so, look, I still have a football from when I was younger. It was made in the U.S. And you're right, the one that I bought my kids made in, you know, China, didn't hold up at all.
Yeah. I mean, the difference in quality is so apparent. But it's one of those great stories as we kick off the season, to be able to show that that some great American workers in Ohio had a part in making that happen.
Good on them. I saw you on C-SPAN not too long ago, and good on you. Did an amazing job. I love seeing you on C-SPAN and other places promoting the idea of making stuff here and protecting jobs here at home. But you were talking about, you know, the idea of allowing Chinese EVs into the U.S. market. And we've talked about this before and how it could lead basically to the extinction of the U.S. auto industry. Do you believe that?
Yeah, I really do. And I'll tell you why, just in terms of data. Okay. We sell about 15 million vehicles in the United States every year, new vehicles, give or take, but about 15 million. In China alone, they have enough overcapacity. And by overcapacity, we mean they have way more factories and way more production than they can possibly sell in China itself, okay? Their overcapacity is somewhere between 10 and 15 million automobiles a year. So these are vehicles that will never be sold in China and that they have to find a home for. And so if you let those vehicles in the United States, it depresses the prices, which will wipe out our auto sector. And look, I want to keep prices down like everybody else. But ultimately, if you let China in the door, what'll happen is it'll wipe out all of the competition and they'll overtake the market. And that's not a good thing to see for our workers in the auto sector or anywhere else in manufacturing, for that matter, Rick. And then that obviously has spillover effects for national security and for the communities that those factories are in and what have you. So every chance I get, and this is a policy difference too. This is like the Biden-Harris administration wants to put 100% tariffs in place on these Chinese vehicles coming in. Okay, just to say, no, you can't do it here. They also have deep concerns about data in Chinese companies, rightfully so, right? So they don't want Chinese auto companies collecting data from connected vehicles in the United States. In fact, they want to exclude them from the market that way. I have heard Trump say he would welcome Chinese companies to come set up shop in the United States and sell the vehicles here. I personally think that's a terrible idea because, again, they have a different cost of capital. I worry about data security, and I don't think it's a good thing at all. And it's nothing like what happened when Japan or Korea came in. You know, I wish those companies were more labor friendly, quite frankly, but the juggernaut of these Chinese companies coming in would completely wipe out the industry, including those factories that have moved here from Europe and from Japan and South Korea as well.
Right? And, you know, especially on the new technology, the EVs, Tesla has the market right now for the most part. This, in your estimation, then would wipe out Tesla then?
Oh, yeah. 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 The you know, there's 10 or 12 Chinese EV companies that are fully mature and that have the ability to sell cars at $15,000-$20,000 a pop. That would put, you know, Tesla would be a Tesla's already, you know, dropped in the world rankings, right? They were number one, they're down to number two, and they're facing challenges in a lot of markets because of this heavily subsidized competition that comes from China, right?
And look, you talk about, you know, the Chinese having our data. I'm not thrilled with Elon Musk having all this data, to be honest with you, either. But what this does show, and it goes back to the football. Look, when I was a kid, you could buy an American-made football. I couldn't find one for my kids when they were small. I'm thrilled that there's one that's out there. But we were told that by allowing these Chinese goods in, we would have choice. We could choose the little bit more expensive American-made product or the cheap garbage from China. We were told that. The sad reality is, well, they've basically eliminated all the competition, and all that's left is Chinese products. And that was okay for footballs or, you know, plastic whatnots. But now we're talking about the auto industry, which, what's the statistic? 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 jobs is tied directly to the auto industry. This could be catastrophic for our economy at a time when AI is threatening to take, you know, millions more jobs.
That's right. I mean, in the auto sector alone is responsible for like 3% of our GDP. So that's measurable, right? If you think about it, that's pretty enormous when you consider the size of the US economy. So it would have a disastrous effect. And here's the thing, like, we know how this turns out. This happened in the glass sector, flat glass. You know, there used to be a lot of flat glass made in Ohio by American companies. They were the best. They got totally driven downward by subsidized Chinese competition, by the Chinese-owned factories and state-supported factories. And in fact, it's so bad now that, you know, these glass factories were diminished. You know, one Chinese company, Fuyao, set up shop in Dayton, Ohio, has become the largest glass manufacturer in the United States. And here's the deal. They have resisted the UAW, which was chronicled in the movie American Factory, by the way. And all those profits go back to China. You know, they don't stay in the United States. And so it's been really harmful. So I do not want to see that happen. And, you know, God bless the Chinese if they end up with companies that actually have a level of cost of capital that's comparable to the rest of the world, and they aren't subsidized, and they stop exploiting labor and the environment, all that. I welcome fair competition, but that's not what we have right now.
Yeah. Now, I understand recently Congress was supposed to have a China week. Did I miss it again?
Yeah, this is kind of like Infrastructure Week, right? During the Trump administration, where every week was Infrastructure Week, and it became a punchline. And so what I think is so upsetting about this, and yeah, Congress right now is working through a number of pieces of legislation that have some connection to China. A lot of these are what I would call messaging bills. I mean, some of them might make a difference at the edges on things like access to collaborative biopharmaceutical research and things like that. But when it comes to sharpening our trade tools or limiting the kinds of investments that U.S. companies can make in China and then turn over to the Chinese, or when it comes to like revoking permanent normal trade relations for China, none of those are on the table. And here's the thing. It's like, you know, these measures have been recommended by the Select Committee on China. We have lifted them up in our testimony. There's broad public support for doing more. And so what happened is just like, you know, what happens all too often, Rick, the big global companies and the trade associations went to the Republican leadership and say, hey, we don't want anything that's going to really, really hurt us. Wink, wink. Do some stuff, but don't do anything that's really going to, you know, going to make us make too big of a cut or impact our operations in China. And so that's what's happened. So it's end up being, I called it China Week, W-E-A-K, instead of China Week.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so we can and should do better.
No, we should, because there's a lot of things that need to be done. Look, if we're not going to, you know, undo the horrible policies of the past, like revoking permanent normal trade relations, which I think we should do immediately and probably should have never done to begin with. If that's not going to happen, there are other things we should be at least looking at. And you talk about this de minimis thing all the time.
Yeah, de minimis. This
seems to be something that we should be going, hey, this is a loophole that maybe we should be looking at closing and could actually help a little bit.
Yeah, it absolutely could. And, you know, it's so bad that you have U.S. retailers who play by the rules, who normally import a lot from China, saying, we got to do de minimis reform, because this is killing us, because, you know, all these goods are coming shipped direct to consumer from China, and they're knockoffs. They're not good quality. You know, we've talked about that. They're impossibly priced and they're wiping us out. And so, yeah, that would have been an easy one, too. And we know there's a lot of support for this. And this is something that has been thoroughly vetted. So it's a super missed opportunity. But, hey, House Republicans will get to go home and say, hey, we did some bills on China. But it's not going to make, you know, too much of a difference in the lives of Americans, or really help us with respect to economic security when it comes to those concerns with China.
Because this is the weird thing. I mean, this is an issue that universally, this is nonpartisan. Everybody, yeah, I talk to, red hat, blue hat, green hat, you know, pink hat, everybody seems to be on the page of, no, we shouldn't allow China to come in and buy up all of our farmland and take over our factories and flood our markets with impossibly cheaply priced goods. That's not what we want. And yet we don't seem to get anything done on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the one thing that got done was the TikTok legislation, right? And it was only because it was like front and center, and the Congress was still looking to do something to China because of the spy balloon stuff too, right? But we can do better than that. And look, TikTok is important.
Well, what'd they do to TikTok?
Conversation.
Did I miss that too? Because I still see people on TikTok.
Oh no, it's there. But there's they passed a bill that says, within a certain period of time, the company has to come under control that is not Chinese, basically, in order to keep operating in the United States. So we'll see if that happens. But the problem is that for the real nuts and bolts stuff, yeah, that got left on the cutting room floor when the big global companies, you know, walked in and said, hey, you know, just don't do anything that's going to really hurt us too much. You know, you can talk all you want, but don't do anything that's actually going to hurt our operations in China.
The lobbyists win. Working people get stiffed again. It's infuriating. And thank goodness you're out there fighting the good fights. Oh, folks, take a look at the website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Scott, as always, I appreciate the time.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you. Thank you.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Nonpartisan issue. Would you like to see something done on China and ending this flow of cheap, you know what? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1859. That was the day that the St. Anthony and Minneapolis Typographical Union No. 42 was founded in Minnesota. It was one of the oldest unions on record in the state. 3 years earlier, printers in St. Paul had formed a union, Local 30, with a dinner to honor Benjamin Franklin's birthday. At the time, just over 6,000 white people lived in the state of Minnesota. Typographical workers were very important to the early labor movement in the United States. These printers were vital to spreading the word about the cause of labor to other workers in the era before radio, television, or computers. In Minnesota, 8 journeyman printers joined together to form Local 42. According to the History of Hennepin County and the City of Minneapolis, published in 1881, quote, the union was prosperous, having at one time on its list every journeyman printer within its jurisdiction. The War of the Rebellion practically dissolved the organization, 5 of its members entering the Union Army. Like it did for many fledgling unions, the Civil War took its toll on the Typographical Union Local 42 membership. One member, H.M. Metcalf, was killed in battle. The union was disbanded during the Civil War, reforming a decade later. Although the Civil War had disrupted labor organizing across the North, the years following the conflict saw a surge in labor activity. Wages stagnated during the war, while prices for goods continued to soar. Workers banded together for fair pay and against the exploitation that grew along with increasing industrialization. These early labor unions were prominently made up of skilled workers like these printers. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, it's one of the things that I love talking about with Scott, the idea of making things in the U.S. is the reason we have Scott on so often, because the folks over at the Alliance for American Manufacturing, they do an incredible job of pointing this stuff out and following up on it, a great resource. But, you know, the fact that EVs could be the next item that goes the way of the China cycle it should frighten all of us, because we've watched product after product, industry after industry, be gobbled up by China. And it, look, you know, honestly, you know, corporate greed is at the heart of all of this. American companies thinking that they can somehow, you know, cheapen production by moving to China because, hey, exploitable labor, lax environmental regulations, that's like heroin to a CEO. So you get into this cycle that's happened over and over and over again. You know, starting, you know, what with the pickles back in, you know, in the late 90s. You know, Walmart forced, you know, the pickle company to make bigger jars, and you know, this idea of big retailers forcing manufacturers to seek the cheapest possible labor, and then ultimately going to China, the Chamber of Commerce being the conduit that helps. I wonder what the kickback that they've gotten, but it's this cycle that we've seen in item after item. You get this multinational company who goes, hey, we can get cheap labor, lax environmental stuff, and oh, hey, there's big money, in subsidies from the Chinese government, free money, and then the idea that hey, we're going to be able to sell in their market, so we're going to have an American footprint in the Chinese market. That doesn't happen. So what happens? You get this company that goes over there, and we've seen this story after story, time and time again. You get this company that goes over there. They're not allowed to own the local venture because everything is about joint ventures. Everything is about ensuring that the Chinese control the factors of production. So if you're an American company, you only get to own 49% of your company. The Chinese own it. So what do you end up seeing? Well, they end up stealing your technology. Surprise! And I've said for years that I have no sympathy for an American company that goes to China and gets ripped off. It's what they do. It's what you've seen time and time and time again. So it's not shocking. But even if they don't rip off your technology with your consent, they reverse engineer it and end up doing the same kind of thing. So China's really been doing a lot of things to steal U.S. technology and, well, replicate it. And they've appropriated this technology in various ways, espionage, outright theft. And once it gets into the hands of a Chinese firm, a domestically owned Chinese firm, they don't need that U.S. company anymore. And it's basically frozen out because the Chinese people still think in a nationalistic kind of way. We want Chinese, you know, we want made in China. We want our goods here made by our workers here. We're the only dumb ones who go, no, we don't care where it's made. We just want cheap stuff. Got to fix our addiction. And what you then see is you see these Chinese companies that are able to squeeze the American, the multinational, I'll say, because these aren't real American companies, American-based formerly. And you see them getting squeezed out. And then the Chinese companies then take this. They out compete these multinational companies in the world market because they got cheaper labor, lax environmental regulations, and massive subsidies from their government. And they can crush domestic industries, which is what Scott was talking about EVs. We in this country are talking about the future of automobile travel, part of it being EVs. This is the new technology. This is where the world is moving towards. And if we fall behind, we're going to lose out. And China's already, you know, stolen enough technology to start pumping out cheap stuff. And if we allow them into this market, it's going to be like footballs. Good luck finding an American-made anything. This is why I've been saying, you know, Joe Biden's administration has been transformational in moving us away from this neoliberal thought process of, I don't care where it's made, we just need cheap stuff. You know, the Walmart commercial, better living through lower prices. Well, what do those lower prices mean? Well, they mean no jobs here. They mean nobody working, doing those jobs, making those things. That's what it means. And as we talked about the other day, the idea of where you buy something and from whom you buy it really kind of matters. And we need to think about that again. I try and use the mom and pops whenever I can. Wherever there's something that I can use locally, not just domestically, but in my neighborhood, I do, because I know that dollar is going to go through the local economy. I haven't been in a Walmart in 25 years now? But, you know, Target's the same kind of thing. Once you spend money there, it goes to the home office. It doesn't reverberate. So for me, this idea of having a conversation about what kind of an economy we want, this is part of it. This is part of it. And something we most certainly should be getting in front of, because, and I've said this before, the job you may save or create may be your own. And I think back to 2015, 2016, when Trump came down the elevator and brainwashed my family. Otherwise known as the basket of deplorables. Look, they were always homophobic and racist and misogynistic and all those things. It's just what it was. Never motivated them to vote. But when Trump said, hey, I'm going to bring back those jobs that afforded you a solid middle class white lifestyle with the white picket fence and the little house and the car in the driveway and kids who could go on vacation every year and college and all those kind of jobs, they jumped at it. The fact that Trump was going to recreate that dream world that they grew up in and that they wanted to live and then pass on to their children, they bought it wholeheartedly. Hook, line, and sinker. And as Scott Paul pointed out, you know, we had infrastructure every week during the Trump years. We had manufacturing week all the time. Didn't really do anything to bring back manufacturing. In fact, we lost jobs during his tenure. But don't let that be the reality, because the message is, you know, Trump's the guy in the economy. Whereas Joe Biden, while didn't do a lot of the speaking, did a lot of the doing. And this is why Biden's presidency will be remembered as transformational, but only if Kamala Harris wins. Because, you know, Don Jr. is already running ads. You know, there's infrastructure money being spent. But we need to take that back. It's crazy, crazy thinking over there. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, freespeech.org for the video. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com.
This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today.